Let's call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:33 p.m. on Friday, January 26, 2024. Before we begin, I want to thank Juliana Singh, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Dylan Williams from the GIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Senator Kaufman, I should say Senator Kaufman, Senator Giesel, Senator Tobin, my vice chair, Senator Keel, and myself, Senator Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first and only order of business today is informational hearing with the Office of Public Advocacy about the topic of public guardians. And this is the first information hearing on this topic in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Here remotely to answer questions from the committee is James Stinson, the director of the Office of Public Advocacy. Mr. Stinson, if you would please put yourself on the record. You can provide a brief introduction about your background as well as a brief introduction about the topic of public guardians, and then we'll be on to questions.
Yes, thank you, Chair Klayman. For the record, my name is James Stinson. I am the director of the Office of Public Advocacy. One of the many things the Office of Public Advocacy does is run the Public Guardianship Program. As you are all aware, there has been much press coverage, a lot in the news about the strain that the guardianship system is under. I would say that for the most part, I am thankful for that coverage because I think it's highlighting a very important issue for the state of Alaska. The issues in the guardianship system are not necessarily new. They have taken decades to build, and they've snowballed. There was a point in 2015 before my tenure where it looked like we were coming to a head, but it continued on. And right now, we are at a serious pinch point as the system becomes increasingly strained. You know, as the director of the agency, I want to take control over what I can influence and what I can control. I want to take responsibility for that. But the Supreme Court ruling has made it clear that what I do not have control over is the amount of cases that will come to the agency and when those cases will come to the agency. That's a real challenge because it also hinders the executive and legislative branches from necessarily being able to bring resources to bear for the agency. It takes about 2 years to properly train and certify a guardian. There's no ready, hireable pool of public guardians. And so it creates the potential to have the agency continue to lose certified public guardians and get to a critical point, even if the executive and legislative branches are attempting to respond. That said, I do believe the situation has been temporarily stabilized, and I am thankful for that. Several things have been done. There's been a letter of agreement signed with the unions to give a floating step incentive. People get an increase in their step when they get certified as a guardian, and they get two more if they stay with the agency at least 4 years, and they would lose that if they left. I was also able to find funding through the administration for the new overtime policy, which has been a boon. I found out that has long been part of the culture that's not an option. Finally, there's been additional restructuring in the unit that has improved morale, and there's been additional PCNs. I'm thankful to both the administration and the legislature for those efforts, and I think without those, we would be in a far worse situation. There's also some additional hope on the horizon, both from UAA and the court system. You know, the University of Alaska Anchorage, for the first time, is potentially creating a pipeline for certified guardians. Hopefully in their spring semester, maybe in a fall semester. There's an 18-month course where somebody could take that course and end up passing the National Guardianship Association exam. That would, again, for the first time, provide an actual hiring pool for both private entities as well as the Office of Public Advocacy. I know Douglas Wolliver, the Deputy Administrative Director of the court system, is down in Juneau. He has proposals to better fund and train the court visitors. The court visitors are pretty vital. They're a component of the system because that's who investigates the need for guardianship and finds alternatives to OPA. So certainly that is a component, as well as funding for helping family members who want to be guardians. Oftentimes family members feel deterred from taking on a caseload of one because it can seem overwhelming. And so those efforts are also part of solving this issue. I will say, though, that the situation is serious, and I want to be candid with the committee about that. So I thank you for the opportunity to be here with you today, and I await your questions.
So questions from members of the committee. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stinson, maybe we could start a little bit with some of the lay of the land. I think, if memory serves, you have north of 30 guardian positions. I think there are 5 added in management plan. How many are full?
So, Senator Keel, through the chair, right now they're all filled except for 2. We had a recent resignation bringing us down to 16 certified public guardians, down from 17, and we are waiting to fill a Juno PCN. So right now we are training 3 brand new people, and we have other people in the pipeline basically to become certified, but we have 2 vacancies right now.
I have a question about that. Are you saying, because I thought Senator Keel's question was that there's 31 positions, and now I'm hearing 17 or 16 guardians. What are the other, if the other positions are filled, what are they doing?
Yes, so Chair Klayman, just for clarification, I think this is an understandable point of confusion. Usually in the press and when I'm speaking about certified guardians, what those are is those are individuals who have already passed the National Guardianship Association exam, which is required to be a full case carrying public guardian 2. What we're doing, and this was part of a restructuring that took place in 21 to 22, is we hire people at an entry level public guardian 1, but they're not capable of carrying cases at that time. They have to slowly get trained up, and then right around the time that they're taking their exam, they will be carrying some amount of cases. But that's the distinction there. And so when you're hearing certified guardians, those are guardians that per the statute have passed the NGA exam and are able to carry a full caseload.
So does that mean right now you've got, of the 31 positions, you've got all but one or two are currently filled, but only about half of those are actually certified public guardians?
Chair Klayman, that's correct.
And looking back over that, you've been public advocate since 2019, I think?
That's correct.
Has that number of public guardians ever been significantly different from 16 or 17 than it is today? I'm just trying to get an idea of the turnover you're going through.
Yeah, Chair Klayman, that's been the real challenge. I think perhaps at one point we may have had 19 or so, I believe, when I presented last year in front of Senator Keel and the subcommittee, we were at 17. One of the issues we're running into is the rolling rate of attrition is sort of leaving us almost with the same amount, and then over time, slightly less certified guardians. That's a big problem.
Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, just trying to sort of paint the baseline picture here, get my head in the right place. Can you talk to us about the sort of level? Most of us don't work with a public guardian or a guardian on a regular basis. What is the training level? What's the skill level roughly equivalent to if we were to think about it? I mean, is this a paralegal? Is this an eligibility tech? I mean, what would you say is a comparable amount of training or ability someone needs to have to get that certification?
Yeah, Senator Keel, through the chair, thank you for the question. It's a highly unique position, even with OPA being the eclectic agency that it is, it's unique among that. We actually have eligibility technicians assisting the public guardians, so it's certainly more than that. I suppose I could go through the laundry list if it would help of some of the things that they need to know, if that would be helpful.
I think that would be, yes.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, so one of the challenges we face is somebody starts up as a public guardian, they think they sort of have an idea of what the job is, and they find out that they sort of have to be kind of an attorney, kind of a real estate agent, kind of an accountant, kind of a doctor. And so you need to understand Medicaid and Medicaid eligibility. You need to understand general relief eligibility. You need to understand Social Security Title II and Title 16 eligibility. You have to understand trusts, income, and assets and how those trusts interplay with eligibility and resources. You need to understand how all income and assets are going to affect eligibility for needs-based benefits. You have to understand guardianship ethics and the standards under the NGA. medical decision-making. You need to know how to open a conservator account, manage income. You have to understand real estate transactions, how those real estate transactions affect eligibility, how to interact with all financial institutions with guardianship and conservatorship orders, which is an ongoing challenge, food stamp eligibility and renewals, all housing options, what Medicaid waivers cover for housing, the need to be appointed rep PE by Social Security potentially, taxes, applying for PFDs, the person's personal vocational needs and wants, their triggers, everything about an individual. Mental health and disability services backgrounds are often good. So there's a lot. I mean, that's kind of off the top of my head what I can think of.
Go ahead, Senator Keel.
Thank you. And so I was pleased that I think what, it was 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago, you got the letter of agreement with the pay bump. What is the range class for the public guardian or for the public guardians you have? I'm sorry.
Senator Keel, through the chair, the entry-level position starts at a range 16, and then the case carrying goes to a range 18. I think there goes to range 18, and then from there it goes up, I believe, by one at a public guardian 3, which they can be a supervisor or not. I believe it's 19, and then a public guardian 4 should be a 20, if I'm not mistaken. And there's one public guardian 4.
Thank you.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Sitton, for being here. My question continues to build off those that you've heard as we learned in the budget subcommittee last year that your attrition rate was rather high. And if I'm reading correctly from my notes, that at that time you had 4 folks leave in the last 4 months. So I have a two-part question here. What is the attrition for the last 6 months? And also, I'm going to be very frank. I think there's been a fracture in public trust. And so what is it that we can help you with in regaining that public trust, either through tactics or other supports we can provide to retain and build up your labor force?
And so through the chair, Senator Tobin, thank you for the question. You know, the attrition rate remains more or less a consistent issue. I was able to prevent multiple resignations for the time being. However, we do have people on the horizon to retire or leave state in June. So we have 2 people that we anticipate becoming certified, and they're fantastic guardians. But the issue is by June, we'll have 2 more leave. And so at least in the immediate coming months, we're sort of looking at a 0 net gain. We have 5 more people who in the next year, if they stick around, should become certified. In terms of public trust, I acknowledge that just given the uniqueness and complexity of guardianship, it's very hard to adequately explain what's going on in a series of sound bites. It's also a confidential proceeding. So the only time the general public is even aware there's an issue is when something goes wrong. But what I will say is we made the decision before the Supreme Court even issued their decision that we were going to jump into the scrum with Judge Arcef and do everything we could to fix what happened with the cash integrity matters. And we're continuing to do that. And I'm thankful for Judge Arcef's guidance in that process. So I understand that there's been some public perception. I'm more than happy to answer, you know, detailed questions on that.
Let's go back again to the number of positions. If in the current fiscal year at 21 is the current request from the executive branch to increase your guardian positions by 5, or do you know?
Chair Klayman, there's been a lot of moving pieces. I'm not necessarily certain. I think so. Because we were given approval to double and triple fill positions in advance. So one of the things that's been confusing on our end is to get those PCNs built. But in the interim, we've already filled them, which is good. I think the Gov budget also includes additional long-term non-permanent positions. And I believe there's a PG1, a PG2, a paralegal, and a eligibility tech 2, if I'm not mistaken, as well.
Well, it sounds like there's some uncertainty, and this obviously is not a budget committee, but the question I have, it sounds to me like the number of certified guardians you have in the 31 positions currently are running between 15 and 17 at any time, but not very often much above. You're kind of holding at that 15 to 7, I guess, a PG2 under your department terminology. To actually manage the full caseload, how many PG2s do you really need to be able to effectively manage the caseload at a tolerable level, work level for the public guardians? I'm thinking you need more than 16, but I'm wondering what your estimate is.
Well, Chair Klayman, that's part of the challenge, and I think that's why I'm hopeful that the administration is considering, you know, a long-term solution. I think there's a question of what can the labor force support practically. There's also a question of the bottleneck of training that we're facing. It's difficult to train the three new people that we have right now, given the caseloads. What I can tell you is I think current caseloads are at about 1,627 cases. So depending on what one's opinion is of what's a reasonable caseload, you can do the math on how many cases that equates to, obviously, per certified guardian. And the reason that number is potentially important is it'll highlight the vulnerability. Now, we have non-certified guardians carrying lower caseloads, but the number of certified guardians is important because those are the people who have been there long enough to have the expertise you need, typically.
Right, but on that topic, if I'm doing the rough math, if you got roughly 1,600 cases and you've got 16 public guardian twos, that means that are the licensed guardians, essentially means 100 per public guardian, and that sounds like more than they can reasonably manage for their caseload. And you're the guy who runs this particular office for the state. I mean, is a more realistic management number that should be 50 or 60 cases per guardian?
Chair Klayman, I will say that it's been widely reported that the National Guardianship Association standard has been cited as 40. Other states cite guidelines of less. I don't know many states that have more.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I can go back to this, but Senator Tobin.
No, I'm curious. What is the state guideline? Or is there a state guideline?
Senator Tobin, through the chair, there's no number in state statute. There is a state statute that essentially references a high ethical duty, having the highest ethical duty. And then we're also under the National Guardianship Association standards.
Hello?
Senator Tobin.
So one possible tactic or solution would be to establish a state standard. Would you agree with that?
Senator Tobin, through the chair, that is a policy call with the legislature and the executive branch. That is a possibility, yes.
Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you must do exit interviews. What is the reason for the constant turnover?
Yes, so Senator Giesel, through the chair, I've not just done exit interviews, I've actually met individually with just about every public guardian, which is how I've been able to prevent some resignations. And the general consensus, and I can read you a letter from somebody who resigned, but the general consensus is that a public guardian gets to a point where they're so overwhelmed, it's not just that they feel like they're not helping anybody, it's that every decision they make for the benefit of one ward is taking away something for another ward. So I think they reach a point where they feel that they're actually actively harming somebody, given the fact that they have a caseload so heavy with a variety of individuals with complex needs, wants, and desires. And what ends up happening is you just jump from emergency to emergency, which is really not what guardianship is supposed to be. And in doing so, it self-perpetuates additional emergencies because you don't have time to address the underlying things that lead to those emergencies.
Thank you.
You referenced a letter from one of the guardians that resigned. Would you mind reading that to us?
Sure, so Chair Klayman, I won't read the whole letter, but the introduction of the letter essentially talks about how this individual became a public guardian. She actually was volunteering her time before and after work to stay on top of it because she thought it was so essential, and I'll go ahead and start quoting now. This job can mean the difference in someone freezing to death because they don't have adequate housing, starving because they don't have food, being trafficked because it's the only way to gain access to shelter, food, etc. When my caseload rose, I was not just working more hours, I was not sleeping because I was worried about clients not getting services or housing in time. When I was sleeping, I was waking up with tasks I needed to do or had forgotten because the days are so busy and there is hardly time to think. I became so physically, mentally, and emotionally exhausted that I needed to remove myself from the situation and gave my notice. As I think back to this time, it brings me to tears because I believe I failed the people I so desperately wanted to help, the people who accept the responsibilities of being a PG tape seriously and are driven to serve. And for the record, this was an individual who was with the agency for just over 2 years. Looks like they started in 2019 and left in 2022. So they started probably right before my tenure or right around my tenure.
So I want to go back to the questions that Senator Tobin asked about numbers. If the national association that you belong to has a target number of 40, and if even if we expand that and use a number of 50, it sounds like the number of public guardian level two, the ones that are licensed as public guardians that you actually need to manage your caseload, is not 16 but 32.
Chair Klayman, I'm not necessarily disagreeing. I think it's just a question of whether that's a possibility or not.
Well, I mean, I do think that's the possibility is a real topic, but I guess by the same token, if we pretend that we're going to be taking care of some of our most vulnerable Alaskans at a fundamentally underserved level, we as a legislature that make the appropriations are kind of setting yourself up by failure by structurally putting it in a place where you're never going to be able to do the work effectively. I guess I am trying to put words in your mouth.
Well, Chair Klayman, what I'll say is, you know, the impetus behind the moratorium was never about an abdication of duty. It was about this very issue. It was about trying to make the system function as it should and really have the public guardian be chosen as an absolute last resort. And the fear was always that at some point the public guardian would become illusory, right? That there would be and that's tended to be what happened, right? So the moratorium forced the illusion to drop. It forced the system to say that we need to keep eyes on this person because they're not actually being adequately protected. But at the point you have an unlimited appointment to an agency, yes, you reach a point where it truly is illusory because there's no way that you can have over 100 individuals that you're fulfilling their needs for. And that's unfortunate because once OPA is appointed, those other efforts cease. The assumption is that it's fine. And I think guardianship is misunderstood and that it's a very unique type of appointment. It's not like a China appointment. It's not like a criminal appointment. It's not the government coming to take your liberty, your property, your children. And it's not this limited appointment. It's somebody taking full control over another adult human being's life for the duration of their natural life. And when a public guardian becomes overloaded, they hit a point where they're actually an obstruction. They're actually not helping because everything has to flow through them and they don't have the time to have those things flow through them. And so that was part of the impetus for the moratorium.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So while we've been listening to Mr. Stinson, I calculated a little bit. I think a range 16 makes about $27.50 an hour. So that letter of agreement is good for about another 90 cents when you get your certification. I think we're offering $4,000 bonuses to eligibility techs with our SNAP backlog. So we may need to have a significant budget discussion in the subcommittee. In addition to that, Mr. Stinson, do you have suggestions that we as a legislature ought to consider? You mentioned court visitors and hopefully better success finding family members or other private individuals who can serve as guardians. Well, are there other steps we should look at?
Senator Keel, through the chair, I would encourage, although it's above my pay grade, any conversations that can take place with GLO between you all. I think there may be some long-term options on the table. I'm not fully versed in those. And I would say that the efforts that Douglas Wolver is making are pretty vital. I mean, it's a key component. I will also say that even though the court system and OPA may seem to disagree, I really do see them as a partner in this. They're a huge part of the solution. And I'm also hopeful that the court visitor coordinator has taken steps to better train court personnel as well. But I would say right now the main thing on the table, the efforts by Douglas Wolver are a key component.
So Mr. Wolver is here with us in the Judiciary Committee room, so we probably will pull him up here in a couple of minutes. But one of the questions that I have about the people that you're seeing in system structures is there evidence that there are people that are being appointed public guardians that in fact they were not, the decision to appoint the public guardian turns out to not have been necessary. This was somebody that probably would have been fine without a public guardian, and then that there was an effort to reverse the public guardian appointment because they actually were managing their affairs well, or are the people that are getting appointed almost entirely appropriate appointments at this point in time?
Well, Chair Klayman, it's tricky to some extent because the burden shifts to the person placed under protection by clear and convincing evidence to show they no longer need it. So there can be a roadblock there. We have been successful at reducing authorizations. In fact, several of the cash integrity cases have had reduced authorizations, perhaps down to payees and other things. So, you know, OPA's perspective is that, yes, there are issues with over-appointing, that, yes, there has been oftentimes a rush to guardianship, that the way the system operates sometimes incentivizes that because you have very busy judges who are used to appointing people, and they are very well-intentioned, and they have someone brought before them in a 15-minute hearing who's going to have some kind of deficits, right? And so the pressure to err on the side of quote-unquote protecting somebody is very great. Now, if you read the perspective of any public guardian entity in the country, they will tell you that guardianship is the greatest restriction on individual liberty short of incarceration. And so that is our perspective, and it's a very different perspective. And I think the differences in that perspective are part of the problem. But yes, people do get reduced authority. We can go to the Supreme Court and say that we think an appointment was inappropriate. The problem is it'll be 2 years before we hear back, and it's a pretty high standard to overturn a decision on that. And so there are real issues in the system with respondent counsel and others sometimes, in my opinion, also stipulating to things like incapacity. Again, it's there may be some differences of opinion, but what I will say is that the data that I have does tend to suggest in my mind that there is an issue with that.
So give me an idea of what you're talking about in numbers. If you've got roughly 1,600 active guardian appointments today, how many, say in the last year, how many times has the court declined the request for a guardian appointment, finding that the person didn't need a guardian, and how many times have, again, using about a 1,600 index for the number of cases, how many times has there been an effort to undo the guardian appointment that has occurred?
Chair Klayman, one of the challenges on that is I don't know that I have that clear of data. The second challenge is that OPA doesn't necessarily even have the bandwidth, given the overwhelming caseloads, to litigate all that. What I can tell you is that on average we're getting 10 to 20, I think about an average of 15 new cases coming in every month at least. And during the moratorium, I know it on October 11th, I do have this as a data point, so about 5 months in, the wait list had only 14 people on it. And I think even toward the end of the moratorium heading into December, I know there was never more than 30 people on the wait list. So essentially what happened is what would have normally been a much higher volume of appointments, alternatives were found, either family members or payees were used rather than guardianships and conservatorships. So that's actually a pretty decent data set from 7 months to suggest that when there was no OPA option, a lot of alternatives were found. And I offhand can think of five pretty critical cases that did rise to the top. And once we regained past capacity, as you saw in the letters that we kept issuing to the court, those people did get guardians. But in the interim, you know, probate court can be very dynamic, and it's just there's a lot of tools that were not being used, including single transaction authority. A judge can craft through single transaction authority very specific orders that give different people different authority to do things and to usually fix the greatest need for an individual short of full guardianship. So all of those things did happen during that 7 months.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am curious with your comments around new caseloads of between 10 and 20 each month, and I have from my notes in our previous conversation around your fear of the silver tidal wave that is coming, and I would like to ask you to speak a little bit on what you see the future, the next 5 years of the guardianship program and what your need for guardians may be.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Tobin, through the chair. Just about me personally, I can't stop being an optimist. I'd say that's a bad, that's a benefit and a detriment. Optimism is contagious, and sometimes optimism can actually make something work that wouldn't otherwise. So I do have hope moving forward. You know, my desire is to see a robust public guardian section that is truly used as a last resort, but that is always there as a resource to advise and help. And I think you've highlighted my greatest concern. I mean, my grandfather was a long-term Alaskan that got Alzheimer's, and thankfully my family had the resources to address that. And I am worried that in the next 5 years, if something is not done to change these structural issues, we're going to have a lot of elderly Alaskans that put their time in, potentially not have a public guardian section around. And that's my real concern, is there is no reason this can't hit a critical point where we're not going to be able to save it. I'm glad we're having these conversations, but I think if there is some way to fix some of these structural issues or some adequate resource that can get brought to bear, I think we can. I can work with the court system. I can work with the mental health trust. I think we can work together to have creative solutions. But right now, we're in such a bottleneck that if we start getting hit with the quote-unquote silver tsunami, silver tidal wave, whatever you want to call it, which is trickling right now, it's going to be very problematic.
So don't go away, but we're going to have Mr. Wolliver come up and tell us a little bit more about what he's been working on, and then I think we'll have some more questions for you, Mr. Stinson.
Hello, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Doug Wolliver, Deputy Administrative Director for the Alaska Court System. We do have two pieces in our budget this year that touch on guardianship cases. One, as Mr. Stinson mentioned, is increased funding for increased pay for our court visitors. As Mr. Stinson mentioned, court visitors are the ones who do the investigation to make sure that appointment is necessary, that a guardianship is needed or something less than a guardianship is needed. You may recall that it's either last year or the year before, that function was transferred from the Office of Public Advocacy to the court system, which they supported, it was a long time overdue. We have that function now. So part of our request is to beef up our court visitor program by bringing up their rate of pay somewhat so we don't lose them. But a bigger piece of what we're doing in our budget request is we're adding three new positions to the guardianship work who do two things. One, they monitor the private guardians. And private guardians are volunteers and family members. That 71% of all guardians fall into that category. So that's the overwhelming majority is a family member takes care of grandfather. That's the most common scenario. So, but it's complicated. As Mr. Stinson mentioned, listed off that long laundry list of things you need to know in order to be a guardian. Well, some of those apply only to people getting paid to do it, but you know, ethical responsibilities according to national guardianship things. But most of those skills are skills that the average person needs to take care of their friend or family member. It's incredibly complicated. We offer training. There's training on our website. We have a helpline that we use. And for the last, I think, 3 years or so, we've had a federal grant that has paid for two monitors who both monitor the filings, because when people are volunteering, they make a jillion mistakes. And some of those are just innocent, but some of those are reflective of serious mistakes that are being made. These positions will monitor the filings that are submitted by guardians, but they'll also provide training and help. There's a helpline that's available now. These three staff would help with that. The more private citizens who can fill this role appropriately and competently, the fewer end up at OPA. Now, that's not going to solve OPA's problem. OPA's problem is much bigger than just that slice. But if you look at, like Mr. Stinson mentioned, that list, that's overwhelming and intimidating to an awful lot of people, that with a little more support from the court system through training and monitoring would be willing to do that job. So that's kind of, those are the two pieces of our budget requests that kind of touch on the guardianship problems that OPA is having, and we're all having.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, and thank you for that. I am listening to you and thinking about the things my father and I have talked about and done. We've established our durable health proxy, and we've created that power of attorney, and we've gone through a living trust and talked about his long-term care options. I even built an ADU on my house so that if and when he needs that support, we have the facility available, and added his name to the inactive waitlist for our Pioneer home. We have the assets and resources and knowledge to do that. Where do we provide that to families who may not know that these are the pieces that they should be talking about with their loved ones or creating? And is there a space to help with those legal components?
Well, and that's right now at the court system, we provide guidance on those issues. I mean, ideally, you get a lawyer, but if you have the resources for the lawyer, you probably aren't going to be struggling with these things as much. But there is a lot of information on our website, and these three positions, I mean, that would be what they're for. People to call and say, I am overwhelmed, family member needs help, what do I do? And so that's a large part of what these three positions will do. And two, like I say, they've been grant funded, we had a federal grant for this. So we know this is very, very helpful. The grant is expiring, we'd like to keep them.
So, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to be clear, so the 415 you're looking for is for status quo or for program growth?
I believe we have two people under the grant, and we'd like to have three. So growth of one, status quo for the two.
Follow-up?
Senator Keel.
So then at that price point, these are not attorneys providing advice No. to individuals. What will their backgrounds be, and where will you obviously you have two of them. What's your pipeline?
I'll have to find out more about the training that the two have and what this third person would have. I'm not familiar with that, but I'll find out what the pipeline is. But the pipeline is an important question, because you mentioned if we had caps, well, then you still end up with people who need a public guardian. So the public guardian can't take them because they've reached their cap. You still need another resource. They still need another guardian. Right. And just like Mr. Stinson is having a hard time finding trained guardians, it's because there aren't any.
Senator Keel.
Let me put a much less fine point on it. It sounds like you're hiring them out of Mr. Stinson's office.
Actually, I don't think they came from Mr. Stinson's office. No, they're not guardians. These are people who help people fill out the guardianship forms and point them in the direction of resources, and do the monitoring of the reports that come in to flag. As you likely know, I mean, there's fraud in guardianships as well, and abuse in guardianships as well. So these people are trained to look through those reports, look for red flags. Most often red flags are just mistakes. Sometimes they're indicative of fraud and abuse. And so that's a big part of what these three folks do.
On that topic, we had some questions for Mr. Stinson about, are they over-appointing or guardians? It sounds like part of the court's effort is to have some folks to help with the process of the applications that might reduce, to the extent they may be over-appointing guardians. The theory was that your court visitors might reduce some of the, to the extent there is occasional over inappropriate appointments, the theory is that would reduce some of the I don't know if it's fair to say improper, but would it, is that partly to make sure that the appointments are appropriate appointments every time?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And do you see that as occurring already?
Well, like Mr. Stinson said, it's kind of hard to put your finger on the number of over appointments. Some of that is somewhat subjective. One judge thinks it's appropriate. One judge thinks it's not. One guardian says yes. One guardian says no. So it isn't as easy as like number of felonies filed, right? So some of those numbers are really easy and objective. Others are subjective. I Mr. Stinson and I have spoken many times. I know that he believes there is a problem with overappointment. Not everybody thinks there's a problem with overappointment. Kind of depends on which side of the bench I think you sit on. But I'm sure that there are cases that could be done by someone else. But remember, there needs to be a someone else too. It's not just guardians that are a limited resource. It's all the other services. A rep payee, for example, is sometimes all that's needed. And changes by the federal government, Social Security a few years ago, dramatically reduced the number of rep payees in Alaska. So all of these resources that people need are limited.
Is the court system's perspective that there's a problem with overappointment, or is that just Mr. Stinson?
Well, we share, anytime we're overappointing, that's a problem. We just don't know how often that's happening. Okay.
You mentioned some folks that need less aid than a guardian. Are there people that could be appointed a conservator and not a guardian, and what's the difference between the two?
Sure. We appoint conservators as well. Conservator just handles money. A full guardian, sometimes there's a guardian and a conservator. More often there's a guardian that's a full guardian that does everything for a person, all financial, all decisions. And sometimes all you need is help with your money. In those cases, you just get a conservator, and we appoint those as a conservator, not as a guardian.
And if it's a public, does the OPA provide the conservator as well?
I believe so, yeah. Mr. Stinson knows for sure. We mostly talk about guardianships, but I believe he takes conservatorships as well. But he'll know.
Mr. Stinson, do you all provide conservators when those are appointed as well?
Chair Klayman, yes, we do.
And is that the PG1s that aren't licensed yet as a guardian that take on the conservator matters?
No, Chair Klayman, although conservator cases are going to be slightly less complicated, people carry a mix of the cases, usually based on region. There's still a lot to do when you're a public conservator. In terms of a family member, you know, there's a little bit of a different ethical standard, and we like to try to remind people that, you know, family members, they have a caseload of one, essentially. And obviously, if you're dealing with a family member, you're allowed to sort of bleed your own resources into that person in ways that obviously a government, you know, a public official can't. So there is that to consider as well.
Is it your sense that some of the appointments as public guardians would have been appropriately appointed just a conservator and not all the way to a guardian?
Chair Klayman, yes, that's been our perception from the agency, or that sometimes part of what Mr. Wolver has highlighted is a fundamental issue in that someone may just need a rep payee, but if there's no rep payee available, then OPA risks being appointed conservator, right? So, you know, where, for example, we're not supposed to be appointed to ever just handle a trust, but if somebody is being stepped down out of a conservatorship or guardianship and they have a trust, there's always a risk we can get left in that case. And we try to hash out those issues as they come. But OPA's general perspective is that we are seen and have been seen for a long time, not just in guardianships and conservatorships, by the way, but the agency as a whole has to push back against what we see as inappropriate appointments in a variety of fashions, because we're sort of seen as this catch-all, last train stop agency. And so the problem with having, again, this sort of idea of unlimited appointment, yes, do people need guardians, but what happens when you are essentially taking away 1,600-1,700 people's guardian by overappointing the agency? So the other deficits of the system can still fall back on OPA as what we would consider inappropriate appointments when those options aren't there anymore. That's our fear.
So Senator Akil has a question, and then Senator Giesel.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize. I don't want to interrupt the flow. I don't know what a rep payee is. Can someone help me with that?
Mr. Stinson, what's a rep payee?
Yes, so through the chair, Senator Keel, rep payee in this context is just somebody that essentially helps manage benefit money, Social Security, on behalf of an individual. What Mr. Wolver is referring to in terms of the Social Security Administration sort of stepping into Alaska is, I think it was for over 20 years, there was a cottage industry of private rep payees that would charge low, but still what you would consider like a private market rate, fee. And what they would do is they would keep the Social Security money in one account, and then they would have the person pay their fees out of a separate account that usually had either a native corporation dividend check or had a permanent fund dividend check in it. And that continued pretty well in the state of Alaska for a very long time. Social Security finally got around to noticing it. It wasn't that many years back, and basically came in and overnight cleared out an entire cottage industry of rep payees. Now, there are new nonprofit rep payees that have sprung up, but some of them are starting to reach capacity. And so what Mr. Wolver is referring to is I think, that outcome of what Social Security did, and then the issue that happens when you might have existing nonprofit rep payee services. If they're full, OPA is not allowed to be appointed as just a rep payee, which means that if the court thinks that that person needs quote-unquote help, they might just appoint OPA as a full conservator, which from our perspective is very problematic. But that's one of the things that gets risked.
Senator Giesel.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I have a question. It's more a discussion point. I am the guardian for my mother. My sister is her conservator. Just an aside, I think that conservator job is much harder. All those numbers that my sister has to deal with. But my concern is where the pipeline is going to come from for these guardians. We're seeing an exodus of our population age 18 to 64. I mean, this is the age of younger people who would have the ability to fill these roles, which are very complicated. The list that Mr. Stinson gave us, that's pretty complicated. So where is that pipeline when the people that sign on to the job become overwhelmed and burn out in 2 years, right? It's one thing to say, well, let's just hire more. Well, I don't know. It doesn't seem to be working, right? I mean, I'm just listening to Mr. Stinson, and he hasn't been able to expand his staff. It's another thing to say, well, we'll just pay them more. When I listen to the letter Mr. Stinson read, that is a person who cares deeply about his fellow citizens. And money isn't necessarily the motivator for that kind of serving individual. They want to see impact. They want to see that they're making a difference. And yet they can't see that because they're overwhelmed. I mean, it's a vicious circle. I'm in a quandary. Where is the pipeline that we can draw these people with the compassion in their heart to do this job and not burn them out so they leave? I'm at a loss. It's not so much a question,
but it's
the dilemma.
Senator, I think that you raise many of the highlights. It's that if you actually want people to come into a profession, we see it with teachers. If we go through teachers in 2 to 5 years, our education system is going to suffer. And it is suffering. Does paying more alone solve the problem? No, it doesn't. But by the same token, if you're coming into a job that you feel like you're not getting paid very well and you're overwhelmed when you arrive, your odds of staying around go down if the workload gets more manageable and the pay starts seeming more reasonable. the odds that you have a 15 and 20-year guardian, that the odds of the pipeline getting filled and then you keep the retention going, of course, that will help if we get Senate Bill 88 passed.
But that's an aside.
Right, but I mean, it's because... but these are part of the same, all part of the same packages. If we're going to fill the pipeline, it has to be a pipeline that people want to be part of. And if people are statistically leaving in 2 to 5 years, we're never going to fill it.
True. And you bring up the idea of a long-term relationship with an employer and an employee, which is really what SB 88 is about.
Right.
And it's not just the business relationship of I'm paying you to do this job. It's the social relationship of I care about you as an employee, and I'm going to commit to making sure you're cared for even beyond this job, right? So that the folks filling these guardianship jobs know that at some point they're going to need maybe a guardian if they don't have a family member, right? Anyway, it's... we need a pipeline. I don't know how to appeal to one.
And I can't claim to have the answer. I guess our challenge with this hearing is highlights the fact that we have a key component of a relatively small component, but a key component of the services that by law that's there and by court appointments are providing a service and people that are need that service. The people that are providing that service are walking into a terrible work environment. Both, I mean, at the start of the list is that the level of work is overwhelming and would wear any of us out. Not really a question for either of the people you're looking at, but Senator Keel, you look like you have a question.
Well, I'll start with an amen. but then I might shift to a question. The piece it would be helpful to understand more about, I'm hoping that Mr. Stinson or possibly Mr. Wolliver can inform us a little bit, is the private piece. And as I've looked at some other states, they have, you know, professional associations of guardians and the like. And I see a lot of attorneys and some paralegals in those associations. And I don't want to suggest that that's the answer to indigent folks with severe deficits, right? Because they don't have the assets. We're going to need a public guardian. But I suspect that, at least in those states, it's a part of that cycle of a pipeline of trained people, passionate people, some of whom will work private, some will work public, and there may even be a crossover. Certainly there's been stuff in the news about an attempt at one particular private guardianship provider. But I wonder, and Mr. Chairman, I assume Mr. Stinson is the right person. I'm happy to hear from anyone. If we could get a little bit of a sketch of what that private side looks like in Alaska outside of the individual family members with a caseload of one. So I guess, Mr. Chairman, I'll point that right at Mr. Stinson and ask him for his best sketch.
Mr. Stinson.
Yeah, so Chair Klayman, through the chair, Senator Keel. So thank you for the question. A lot of private guardianship providers, they do have the most resourced clients, right? They have the people that have substantial assets and pay a high amount of fees. I think the experiment with Cash Integrity was to attempt to make a nonprofit for people that aren't that resourced, right, but could afford some kind of a sliding scale, and we know what happened with that. I guess the downside of that happening is probably created more of a chilling effect for the ability to have those kind of solutions proposed again. And I would tell you that everybody has probably once been twice shy with that. Most private providers that I'm aware of, they don't take more than 20 cases. There is a private guardian in Fairbanks I know who was actually ordered to reduce her caseload. I think she had gotten into the 50s. She's at, I believe, 57 or so, and she's been ordered to reduce her caseload down to 40. And I think OPA's fear is that those cases will probably also come to OPA. So the private provider sector is pretty slim. There's only an individual license. I think there's been talk of whether there could be a private organizational license. That's one thing that's been discussed, and whether or not there could be traction for somebody doing that in the private arena. But that's what I know in sort of a nutshell.
I have a slightly different question that's compared to some of the ones. This was asked by folks that we hear from. Does OPA collect aggregate data pertaining to guardianship for Alaskans with cognitive decline? This would particularly be an Alzheimer's and dementia population that often are appointed guardians. Does OPA collect data on that?
Chair Klayman, no, not specifically. I mean, we have general categories, but then we have a lot of co-occurring morbidities, people who can be classified under more than one. So we don't always have a good mechanism for identifying that, but no, we wouldn't have specific data at this juncture on just like a primary Alzheimer's diagnosis.
And I take it in response to one of the earlier questions we asked, in fact, your office caseload is so high to actually start trying to collect aggregate data like that would actually overwhelm the system, overwhelm an already overwhelmed system.
Chair Klayman, that's part of the challenge, is the things we could potentially do to reduce cases, like filing things in court and asking for reductions, we really don't even have the bandwidth to do. So it's a real pinch point.
I'm looking to see if anyone has other questions. I don't see other questions. I know that I would imagine this will become a topic as we get into budget discussions. And I guess the only other question I would ask is, are there some efforts that have been made in other states that you would think we might want to try in Alaska? And I specifically direct that as short of a statutory change, because right now there's no legislation proposing a statutory change. Are there things that have been done in other states that we might consider here in Alaska that we're not doing?
Well, Chair Klayman, I can tell you the three things generally that other states do, but that might involve legislation.
Okay.
You know,
tell us those three things. Mr. Stinson?
Oh, sorry. Did you want me to answer with those three things?
Yes. Tell us those three things.
Yeah, Chair Klayman, so near as I can tell, I've studied this whenever I've had time. States seem to do one of three things. Either the public guardian itself screens the cases. That seems to be common because the public guardian has the expertise to kind of make a determination of whether somebody really, really wants a guardian. In some states, the public guardian is housed in the judiciary. Alaska moved the public guardian from the judiciary in 1986. And I think that caused some structural issues. I think we were one of only six states, at least by the 90s, that had a quote-unquote standalone public guardian section. A lot of other states generally just restrict it. A lot of states like Tennessee, for example, they don't allow public guardianship unless somebody is 60 or older. So you'll find public guardian sections are embedded in like an Office of Elder Affairs or something. Oftentimes, public guardian offices are also part of sort of a DHSS or, you know, Division of Family Services type entity. So oftentimes the PG chooses the cases. Oftentimes there's just systems that are much more restrictive, which can cause its own problem. Or there's a mechanism typically for the public guardian to refuse cases if it's at capacity and then bring resources to bear in an orderly fashion. Those seem to be the three main mechanisms.
Has there been criticism in other states where the public guardian is doing the screening that the public guard, has there been criticism that sometimes creates conflicts if the public guardian is overloaded in numbers, the public guardian may be someone inclined not to make an appointment that they otherwise might make based on system capacity?
Yeah, Chair Klayman, I'm guessing that that's most often the case in systems where they're actually part of the judiciary itself, I think like in Nebraska. Right. And so Nebraska has two completely different procedures for when the public guardian says they're at capacity versus when they say they're not. So I'm guessing that's how some states handle it. But I think Texas and other states, I don't believe that's with the judiciary, and I think they just employ a sort of a refusal at a certain point model as opposed to a screening model. But what I would say is that if there was that mechanism, then it would still make sense to have, I think, somebody embedded with the public guardian section that helps screen incoming cases, because then there would be incentive to have that discussion on the front end. So I'm guessing that there might be sort of a hybridized incentive that it's not necessarily that the public guardian would say yay or nay, but that they would caution, like, hey, do you really want this to be a case that we accept because you know there's X capacity? So is this, you know, is this the most pressing need? And I think that's probably how a lot of states do it. I'm not going to say that every state model is better. I mean, I was pretty shocked to find that Oregon has 8 public guardians for 4.3 million people, and they just keep a wait list of 500 to 1,000 people. But it did surprise me that Oregon's total ward load was between 1,600 and 3,000, which, you know, we're heading back to 1,700. If our raw number totals are the same for a state of 6 times our population, that seems odd to me, even though I'll be the first as somebody who's born and raised here to say that, yes, Alaska is unique. Yes, we have high needs. But that seemed to be dramatically out of whack when our raw numbers, I'm not talking per capita, but if our raw number ward needs are comparable to states with millions of people, I think that's speaking maybe to an issue. I don't know.
Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman, just so we don't get the wrong impression, right? We have the unit, sort of the centralized state here with a lot of the powers that devolve to counties elsewhere. So Multnomah County, where Portland is, has a dozen guardians, public guardians. I don't know what their ward load is, but so it's not just the state office there. We have county offices as well.
All right.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Keel. Yeah, thank you for that clarification. I know that the main office increased up to 8, and I think what they said their capacity was still pretty surprising for a state of that size. But I take your point.
Well, I don't see other questions from anyone else on the committee. So we are going to adjourn for the day. Mr. Stinson, thank you very much for joining us today. I can't say we won't have another one to ask a bit more, and I'm sure I think this committee is involved in some of the budget discussions. Senator Keel chairs on one of the budget subcommittees, so we'll have another opportunity in that one as well. But appreciate you taking the time today, Mr. Wolliver. Thank you for joining us as well and attending. We keep the option open of a follow-up on this topic, but we're going to adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Monday, January 29 at 1:30. I would note that at this point, the only thing we have listed for hearing on Monday is bills previously heard. I think there's a good possibility as Monday gets closer, we may cancel the hearing, but we're still on the calendar for now. And we will stand adjourned. The time is now 2:35 p.m.